In the news.
Hello there, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for Introduction to American Government.
All right, so we're, kind of midway through the course right now, week number three on the In the News segments. A couple of logistical items I just wanted to mention after consulting with Professor McDaniel and our project director. First, the In the News is dropping, this week is dropping a little later. We're taping on Thursday. We wanted to get the Democratic debates in the can to have those to respond to. But the assignment due date remains the same. It's the one that's indicated on the syllabus. It's also on Canvas. And that due date is Monday, 5 o'clock Central Daylight Time. Not 5 o'clock wherever you happen to be, drinking a mojito on the beach somewhere in Tahiti. 5 o'clock Central Daylight Time. By the way, I'm projecting my aspirations onto you. Also wanted to mention again, to reiterate, the second exam is on Wednesday, August 7th. Okay, so everybody make sure that if you haven't got that marked in your calendars, that certainly needs to be marked in your calendars, all right? Beyond that, things are progressing pretty well. We've had a couple of emails kind of here and there asking for elaboration on some of the comments on the In the News or on the modules. Basically, Professor McDaniel and I have been pretty consistent on this, which is, first of all, read the syllabus, read the instructions, go back and review some of the videos that we put up explaining in detail what we want. But just as a, kind of a Nichols version of what we want, make sure you're connecting in the news segments, that you're connecting your responses to the material that we're covering in the modules and in the web text. A big part of what we're doing here is to try to lay a baseline of knowledge to expose you to broader theoretical understandings of American politics so that you can apply them to what's going on today. As we said, it's not a current events class, but hopefully we're helping to give you some context with which to make sense of what's going on in the world. So when you see things, you understand sort of institutional relationships. When you see something the Trump administration is doing, you understand that, that's kind of a broader conflict between the executive branch and the legislative branch. Or a court case comes down, that's a state matter, and the federal government can only intervene if there's a constitutional. Those sorts of applications are very important, and they move you beyond water cooler conversation into hopefully a better position to appreciate what's going on in American politics. Okay, so with that, we've got three topics we wanted to cover today. A couple more sort of public policy items that I think we'll do first, if that's okay with Professor McDaniel, because I put the burden on him early on. And then we'll talk about the Democratic debates. So there's one Tuesday night and one Wednesday night. But let's start one piece of economic information and one piece of kind of public policy. We'll start, since Professor McDaniel, one of his many areas of expertise is public health. And so I came across this item and I wanted to hear what Professor McDaniel has to say about it. Late last week, there was a couple of items that floated saying the Trump administration had decided they were going to try to pave the way to allow importation of prescription drugs, especially from Canada. And I wanted to, kind of pick your brain, Professor McDaniel. I mean, what's the background here? I mean, is this significant? What are kind of the issues involved, and what do you think about it?
So the price of prescription drugs has really been a major issue within the U.S. More recently, I believe California won a suit against pharmaceutical companies because they had actually actively worked to keep generic drugs off the market. So I think it was like a $300 million win. But the idea is they'd kept certain generic versions of their drugs off the market for 6 months to 2 years, which allowed them to keep gaining money, and we know the generics cost less. We also know that in the U.S., what we pay for prescription drugs is much more than what's paid in other countries. Sometimes it's even a 10 to 1. And one of the major concerns about the U.S. healthcare system is cost. And the idea here is that, we pay more, but are we getting better quality? And in fact, we're paying more and getting either worse or the same quality as others. And so in some cases, you're paying 10 times more for healthcare costs than other nations, but getting basically the same care. And so what we're really concerned about here is efficiency. And there is this concern that the pharmaceutical companies have been kind of taking advantage of the way things have been going on. have been happening and being able to make a great deal of money. There's a lot of concern about the cost of insulin. If you remember a few years back with EpiPens, where they think the price rose, I want to say at least like 100%. You had the other where someone was, the Martin Scarelli, who basically raised the price something almost like 1,000%. And so what you have here is this concern that pharmaceutical companies, one, are making too big of a profit and kind of holding on to things. And further, they're contributing to certain problems if you think about the opioid epidemic. And so it's a way of trying to curtail the power of the pharmaceutical companies by importing some of these drugs. Now, one of the major concerns with this is that if we import drugs from other nations, that will the quality standards be the same? And so right now they're focusing on importing from Canada. And so it's not really clear how all this will work out. Part of it could be just an issue of posturing by putting pressure on the pharmaceutical companies to lower their prices in the U.S. But this is very common for people to basically go to other countries to get their medications. And in fact, there has been really kind of a niche in terms of travel for medical travel, where people have found that they can travel to another country and have a surgery there, and that the cost of travel, stay, and everything will be the same as it would be in the U.S. or maybe even less. So this is a major concern about the U.S. healthcare system. And again, when we talk about the healthcare system, there are really three things we're concerned about. So access, cost, and quality. And there's a concern that a change in any one of those will change the others. And right now, one of the biggest things that's prohibiting access is cost. And there's the fear that if you increase access, you'll raise cost, or if you increase access without raising cost, you'll lower quality. But the idea of finding a balance between these three. And I think that, you know, the Trump administration, this is something that President Trump talked about on the campaign trail. And so it's important to remember that this is something that was a part of his plank in terms of trying to get out and part of his platform and trying to get this out. And now he's acting on this. And it's going to be interesting to see how the pharmaceutical companies react to this really strong pushback against what they're doing in terms of costing or in terms of pricing their various remedies.
Yeah, I'm a couple of things just for our viewers, for our audience. Most of this policy, we talked about the Trump administration. The key position within the administration with respect to prescription drugs is Health and Human Services, and that's, I believe the secretary is Azar, A-Z-A-R. I'm not quite sure on the pronunciation. But there's also the federal, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. And as Professor McDaniel said, you know, big pharma, we always hear about big pharma, these pharmaceutical companies that make, you know, quadrillions of dollars. Quadrillions has got to be a word, right?
Yes,
quadrillions of dollars have opposed allowing cheap imports on some of these drugs from other countries because it'll cut into their profit margin, presumably. I mean, the more you create market forces, the less they're able to dominate a market and set a price level that allows them to buy yachts and private planes and that sort of thing. The pharma uses the argument, as Professor McDaniel mentioned, that, it's a quality issue, right? You know, that the FDA, American drugs and the FDA as the kind of guardian of the safety of the market, make sure that only top quality pharmaceuticals are available to American consumers. When you start allowing people to directly import from other countries, that they don't have quite the same amount of control. Well, it looks like the FDA and pharma have kind of signed off on a plan to deal with some of those issues, at least with respect to Canadian drugs coming in. I see this, Professor McDaniel does some electoral politics, a lot of public policy. I do a little public policy, but mostly electoral politics. So I can't help but thinking of it in the way that Professor McDaniel suggested in the last part of his answer. And that is that this is, healthcare is a critical issue in 2020. It was a critical issue in 2018. And I think it was one of the main reasons the Democrats wiped the floor with the Republicans in that election. And Donald Trump is looking to, not just satisfy his constituents and to fulfill campaign promises, but to develop some sort of legacy on the healthcare issue to allow him and the Republicans to be competitive in 2020, right? Because so far the only legacy is they said they were going to repeal and replace Obamacare, which they didn't do. And in fact, there's some indication the country has pushed even further, that Obamacare is now considered too mild a remedy for the healthcare system. It's certainly on the left, that's the sentiment, right? So clearly, Donald Trump needs to do something to neutralize or to give him better credibility on that issue to prepare him for, the reelect bid. Okay, so.
One thing I did want to add is that pharmaceutical companies are kind of seen as the big evil creatures in this, in terms of their seeking profits. But one thing we have to remember is that they spend a lot of money on research, and that they may have, again, 100 different projects trying to find something that works, and maybe only two work. So in many cases, the reason why they charge so much is to recoup the money lost from the other projects, but also the money to put into future projects. And so part of it is paying off losses from projects that didn't take shape, and then having the money to invest in a new project. And so it's one of these things where you don't want to necessarily, where again, they need to make a profit, you want them to make a profit, but you also want them to make enough so where they can invest, pay off past things, but also invest in the future. But how much do you want them to make? And I think that is one of the big problems. Like, how much actually should they make in order to go into future research? But also, it's important, but in addition to this, the U.S. actually funds a lot of the research as well. The government funds a lot of this research. So, again, they're not on their own in taking part in these projects.
Yeah, and I think that's, it's reasonable, and what we want to do in a class like this is to try to point out, that it's not quite as simple as, good guys and bad guys, and the bad reputation that Big Pharma has, and, I wish we were paid off by Big Pharma to defend them,
yes.
But it's a little overblown for the reasons that Professor McDaniel stated. I would also just say I've done some polling work where we've asked questions about what percentage of people, or we just asked people and then got a percentage, what percentage of people have purchased prescription drugs online? And I don't know if, you guys, as young people, you probably haven't had much occasion to do this, but we're getting figures, between 30 and 40% of Americans say they purchase drugs online, and some appreciable portion of that, let's say one third of the American electorate that's purchased drugs online, some appreciable portion is purchased through a foreign online site or foreign website. The legal status of that is a little dubious. So if you're out there wondering about, well, can't I get drugs from Canada? Well, sure, the same way you can download a movie from Russia, if you want. But its legal status is a little murky at this point. So with that, let's go to our second topic. So that's, kind of pure public policy. Let's hit a little economic policy here. Now, we haven't got to this stage in the modules yet where we're talking about economic policy, but to kind of give you a little bit of a preview, I know it came across an article, again, late last week, that the Federal Reserve Board is cutting interest rates. I'm going to set aside what the Federal Reserve Board is. That's something that you'll encounter in the modules. We describe it quite a bit. But suffice it to say that it's a national federal institution that essentially sets interest rates for member banks. And because those are some of the biggest banks in the United States, the interest rates set by the Fed trickle down to us, to consumers, to people who want to buy a home, just to average consumers. And what they did last week, for the first time in a decade, the Federal Reserve cut the interest rate. They cut it to about 2 to 2.5 percentage points. It sort of varies depending upon the member institutions. So why would the, what does it mean to cut interest rates? What are they trying to do? Well, we've gotten a bunch of pretty good economic news in July. According to the Bureau of Labor statistics, there were 224,000 new jobs added in July, which is, there's usually a bump up in summer, right? That summer jobs, they don't tend to be terribly long lasting, but the educated workforce comes out, there are more jobs, 224,000 new jobs. So that's pretty robust growth. Adjusted growth figures for the second quarter were a little off, but over the course of the year, it looks like about 3 percentage point GDP, gross domestic product, is 3 percentage point increase. That's pretty robust growth. It's not, China growth in the early 2000s, but that's a pretty strong economy. That's a pretty hot economy. So this is an interesting move. Typically, why would you lower interest rates? You would lower interest rates to generate more business. That is to make it easier to borrow money right? Lower interest rates make it easier to borrow money. So you can invest in a new business, in development, in hiring, you could buy homes. In other words, lowering interest rates is a mechanism that the Federal Reserve Board uses to generate or to stimulate economic growth. It's a little odd that they would do it here because it looks like the economy's kind of going pretty strong right now. And in fact, the Fed has been, you know, either kind of neutral on lowering interest rates, or they've even talked about raising interest rates because of the threat of inflation over the past year or so. But here, they're actually cutting interest rates, and it suggests that they want to sustain the growth that's going on right now, that they're a little dubious that it's going to continue. There are a lot of people, I know some economists, one of them in the government department, who's constantly predicting the collapse of the American economy and freaking me out about my retirement. But there are some smart people who think that the economy might be running a little low on steam. And so despite the good job numbers, despite the economic growth, we're talking about jumpstarting the economy. One reason might be that some estimates have put second quarter GDP, so not the annual GDP figure, but second quarter GDP, closer to 1%. And that would indicate an economic slowdown, and that might be something the Fed's looking at. So any thoughts on this? Or?
Yes, I mean, one of the concerns is with the ongoing trade wars where President Trump and the Trump administration is trying so it's seen as a way to basically account for any type of economic losses that may come about. Also, again, the economy has been doing well for a pretty long time, and you actually, you know, you expect the economy to take a dip. It's cyclical, and so again, it's going to do well, then it's going to do poor, do well, and so it's been doing well for a pretty good amount of time. But everybody's waiting for another shoe to fall, and so it's kind of we expect the bad to come. Like, hey, we're really enjoying the good. We expect the bad to come, and people are expecting it to come a little bit sooner. And because of the concerns about really the trade war that is going on, that it may come pretty soon, and it may be fairly harsh. There have been some who argue that this has really been a way to kind of some, again, who are maybe somewhat cynical, see this as a way of bailing out the Trump administration in the sense that the trade war that's being caused by the Trump administration will not hit people as hard because they've softened the landing right now. But again, you've seen this also in terms of bailouts going to farmers because of the trade war. And so again, this might be, but the Fed is independent, and while the president may nominate individuals, it is independent of the presidency, but it might be reacting to, again, what it sees coming down the line and trying to adjust for those things.
Right. So just to distinguish, and this is something we'll talk about again very extensively when we hit to economic policy in the modular discussions and lectures. But the Fed is responsible for something we call monetary policy, interest rates and things like that. It is independent of the executive, although the executive appoints members to the Fed, including the chair. We've also talked, and we won't get into this, but when you talk about government spending, the government federal government spending tax money on infrastructure, raising or lowering taxes, all right, that's fiscal policy. And so a lot of our focus historically has been on fiscal policy, which the federal government has much more control over. But the Fed is kind of put in a separate category or bin. They're in charge of monetary policy, and that is these interest rates and reserve requirements and things like that. They'll make more sense for you when we cover that part of class. So these are both tools. Fiscal and monetary policy are tools that the government has to try to influence the economy. There are a lot of questions about how much control or how much say monetary or fiscal policy has over economic performance and economic growth. That's a time-honored debate in American politics. We just want to make you aware of it. All right, so now we're going to go to our third topic, electoral politics, and in particular, the Democratic presidential nominating process. So let me kind of set the table a little bit. Electoral politics is something that are near and dear to my heart. We're heading into a presidential election year, 2020, but we're still more than a year out from the next general election. The Democratic Party is trying to identify its nominee, the person who will take on Donald Trump in the 2020 election. America, and this is sort of obvious, I guess, when you think about it, but let's put all of this on the table. America has a very unusual system. We actually have two election seasons. The first season is where the major parties, the Democrats and Republicans, identify their candidates who are going to run for office. The second is the general election, in which those candidates face off and, you know, make their case in front of voters to be elected, usually in a two-party contest. There are Libertarians and Green Party candidates, but, you know, because of the electoral system we have in the United States, the dominant parties are heavily advantaged, and that's certainly the case this time. The presidential nominating process is even more particular, right? When we talk about senators or governors, it's a, you know, a single election. So in Texas, you know, the Democrats are trying to identify a candidate to run against John Cornyn, the incumbent Republican for Senate. You know, there's a bunch of Democrats. Royce West has come out, MJ Hager, there's three or four. But there can be one election in March, you know, and the winner will advance and face Cornyn. All right, now the presidential process is different. You don't have one contest. You have a series of contests with different rules held in different states at different times over the course of the winter and spring. Now, why do we do this? It's a long story. It's a crazy system. Most countries, when Professor McDaniel, certainly when I was in graduate school, the thinking was that America's election system was very, very unique. No one was going to kind of do what the United States did, this sort of two-tiered election system where the parties had their contests and then the nation had its contest. Other countries have moved closer to the United States model. Social democratic, socialist, Christian democratic, right-wing parties in Europe, many have moved to a primary system. They've allowed their voters to identify candidates. So in that sense, campaigns across the planet have kind of gotten more Americanized. You know, that they're actually primaries in other countries. But nobody has moved to anything like the American system when it comes to nominating a presidential candidate. Nobody's decided, let's have regionalized, different institutional contexts, different rules spread out across some long period of time. Okay, so why are we talking about this in August, when the first contest will be the Iowa caucuses in February of 2020? Because we can't wait. And what's happened is right now you've got 25 Democratic candidates.
I think one dropped out only to be replaced by somebody else.
So I still think we're at 25, which is the most we've ever had. I think the previous record was 1972 on the Democratic side. In 2016, we had 17 Republicans. So, and what CNN and MSNBC and Fox can't wait for is it's the middle of the summer, unless you're watching The Bachelorette. Kudos to you if you do. There's nothing else on TV, right? So they love this because it's content. And the Democratic Party has allowed, you know, they award debates to first NBC and MSNBC was the first Democratic debate. This last one was awarded to CNN. They said they're not going to allow Fox to have any. So Fox has been allowing the candidates to do town hall forums, one-off town hall forums, which I got to say, is pretty brilliant on Fox's part because the Democrats are shutting them out. But it's 25 candidates, each of whom would love an opportunity to tap into a large cable audience like Fox delivers, right? So you will see these guys and these women on Fox at some point or another. But CNN ran the second debate. Now, there's so many candidates. With 25 of them, CNN basically told them, they said, we can't have 25 candidates. We'll do two nights. Will allow you to have 10 candidates each night, and they set a criterion. The criteria was you have to have raised a certain amount of money, you have to have a certain poll standing, and they're trying to emphasize breadth of support. So you have to, you know, raised X number of dollars across X number of states, depth of support. So, you know, do you have 2% in the polls? And they're going to keep increasing the requirements to exclude candidates as they move forward. But right now, they tend to be fairly inclusive. So 10 candidates Tuesday night, 10 candidates Wednesday night. They randomly assigned them to Tuesday or Wednesday night. So on Tuesday, you had, just randomly, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders for the first time. This is in Detroit. We're on the stage together. On Thursday, along with eight other candidates, on Thursday night, you had Kamala Harris from California and Joe Biden, former vice president, were kind of the big dogs on the Thursday debate, and then a lot of other candidates. Hopefully you watched a little bit. If not, we're going to give you some high-powered analysis here. So, winners, losers, what were your thoughts?
Well, I guess from my standpoint, I'm more concerned, again, because I'm a policy person,
right.
I'm more concerned about questions being asked.
It's so deep.
And so in this regard, I would actually say the loser is probably the American people, because the questions being asked were about how do you evaluate the other candidates? Not what are your policy ideas? How do you evaluate the others? And so in many ways, it turned in kind of into an episode of Real Housewives. Like, you know, I hate you because of this, or I hate you because it became personalized. It became more about who are you as opposed to what do you think? And so that was my major frustration. However, and again, you could clearly see that on the first night where everybody was trying to say, you know, Warren and Sanders are just too crazy. You know, they're just bonkers, but they were able to hold their own. And then again, you saw it last night where you see the continued, again, criticisms of Vice President Biden, but also because Kamala Harris has raised the polls, you see people directing critiques of her specifically regarding marijuana policy. So to me, it's a lot of it is rehashing kind of old things. And again, it's important because past actions are indicative of future actions. But it also gives us really no idea about policy. It gives us about personalities and not about policy. But this is one of the things we're seeing in American elections where they're being driven more and more by personalities. The reason why you see the rise of someone like President Donald Trump or even President Barack Obama, even President George W. Bush is, again, this focus on personalities, much less focus on policy. And again, if you look at how the media treats a lot of things regarding politics, it's about the game and the personalities, not about the actual policy. And so the actual policy ideas weren't there. You'd have to do some more searching for that. And be truthful, part of this might be because they're not that distinct in terms of policy ideas, and that's why they're focusing on personalities. But the problem is, without discussing the policy ideas, and show that, oh, there are some similarities, you don't really understand, okay, what will they do when they get in office? You have an idea of who you'd like to take a road trip with and who you wouldn't, but you have no idea of what they would actually do when they govern. So that's kind of the problems I see with it. But I do think, you know, it's clear that Senator Sanders and Warren were able to kind of hold their own as the moderates kind of said, look, y'all are crazy. I believe Vice President Biden did well considering it. And I do believe Senator Harris took some hits because now she was seen as the rising star. And so people started gunning for her, whereas before they were going after Vice President Biden.
Yeah. Well, let me give you, for a little bit of context here, I went whiteboard on us.
All right.
Dry erase board. Yeah. All right. So if we can get in on this. So this is taken from the last five polls, national polls, that asked people said they're going to vote in the Democratic caucus or the Democratic primary. Who do you support? Or who would you like to see win? So it's not always the same question. And I would encourage you guys, as you guys are consuming poll information, to be attentive to the specifics on how the poll questions are asked. But this is generally known as a trial ballot question, right? If the election were held today, for whom would you vote? Who would you vote for? Who do you support? And here's the average. So you guys see that Joe Biden, former President Biden, is at 32.0%. Bernie Sanders, 16.4%, Elizabeth Warren at 14.8%, and Kamala Harris at 11.0%. All right, now, I would actually suggest that there are tiers to the Democratic contest right now. Biden is clearly in the top tier. In fact, he is the top tier at this point. If you wonder why everybody is, you know, going after Biden, it's because Biden's at 32% and no one else has broken 20. David Axelrod, one of Barack Obama's main advisors, had a great line last night. He said, he says, only in cowboy movies do people fire backwards. And these guys are firing forwards at Biden, right? Then you've got Sanders, Warren, and Harris. And yeah, there's a little bit of separation, I suppose, here, particularly between Sanders and Warren and Harris. But it's not that great. I would put these candidates in a second tier of categories. And so this is trying to make sense of what's going on right now. And as I said, it's way too early. Everybody else is in the next tier. No other candidate is averaging double digits. Buttigieg and Beto and Cory Booker kind of in that, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6% range. None of them have broken out. Is it possible that one of them will break out? Absolutely. Would I take one of these candidates or would I take the field if I were a betting man? I don't know. I'd probably take one of these candidates, but the field is still quite possible right now. So everything, of course, is still up in the air. One of the things that's interesting is that Sanders and Warren, I think, are clearly competing for the same constituencies. And that is to say, sort of educated, white, liberal, Democratic voters. And you see this in their rhetoric. Professor McDaniel was talking about the kind of policy deficit going on right now. Well, it is true that whatever you think about Warren and Sanders, they have plans. Sanders has kind of more amorphous plans, you know. You guys might remember from a couple years ago, Larry David on Saturday Night Live had these great sketches. He was playing Bernie Sanders. He's basically completely channeling Bernie Sanders in these performances. And I think Julia Louise Dreyfus was the guest host, and she asks him, you know, in the opening cold open skit, asks him, so Senator Sanders, you say they're going to break up the banks. How are you going to do that? And the Larry David guy is Bernie Sanders goes, well, I'm just going to break them up. And she goes, yeah, but how are you going to do that? And he says, I'm going to break them up. So he does have plans. The specifics are a little, you know, kind of in the wind. Warren has kind of sensed this, and Warren has come up with some very specific plans. I think of all the candidates, she's the one who's the most detailed. In fact, it's not only that she's developed these plans and is articulating them, it's become her brand. Her brand is as the specific policy wonk, which I think is pretty brilliant. So if you're asking me what's going on here, I can't help but look at Warren and think a lot of this 16% that Sanders is pulling down right now. Now, Bernie's supporters are very, very loyal. But, man, I tell you, I would not be surprised to see Warren continue to carve out voters. And I think most of them are going to come from Sanders. I'm kind of bullish on Warren as a candidate and a little bearish on Sanders. The other interesting comparison is this Biden and Harris comparison, because Biden is winning a lot of blue-collar, working-class Democrats and African-American supporters because of his association with Barack Obama and, you know, to be fair, other policy achievements he's had that have attracted him to the African-American community. But Harris, I think, looks at Biden, I'm telling you right now, if her consultants are making their money's worth, they're looking at Biden and thinking that she ought to be growing out of Biden. I think if African-American voters sense a weakness in Biden and sense that Harris is coming, I think because of her chops as a prosecutor, she was attorney general in the state of California, which allows her to speak to, you know, working class voters who are concerned about crime and these sorts of things. I think her natural constituency is a lot of the people who are supporting Biden right now. So it's a little bit of an oversimplification, but at any rate, I think that's kind of where we are. From last night and the night before, a couple of winners. I thought Warren continues to have a plan, a general strategic plan as well as these policy plans. I thought she had a very good night. What happened on Tuesday night was all of the moderates, including people like Bullock from Montana, who's a moderate, and some others, they came out and basically took aim at Warren and Sanders and said, hey, you know, this, everybody goes to college for free, everybody gets free health care, you know, including illegal immigrants, undocumented workers, illegal immigrants. That's not going to sell in the general election. And I thought they actually made a pretty credible case, but Warren had the line of the night. She said something to the effect of, I'm paraphrasing here, I don't understand why you'd run for president just to tell us what we can't do. That's a great line. That is a great line. I think it was the line of the night. And if she did nothing else, that line will get repeated, I think, in commercials from here on in. Sanders was a little more screechy in his response, and it kind of got flummoxed from time to time. So I thought Warren had a good night. I thought the, you know, third-tier candidates had a pretty good night. Williamson and Yang. Okay, so Marianne Williamson, she's the one who's the Oprah's spiritual advisor, and she, I don't know how to judge her. I actually think she probably had a pretty good night, even though I'm sort of the opinion, I'm not sure why she's on the stage.
We need to consult the spirits first.
To consult the spirits. She said there is a dark psychic force surrounding the presidency. And at first I laughed when I heard that, and then I thought, actually, that might play pretty well. And so she had a pretty good night. And Yang, who is an entrepreneur whose single issue, it was sort of a guaranteed income, but he's decided that nobody was going for that, and it didn't sound very good. So he rebranded it as a freedom dividend, I think he's calling it, a freedom dividend. And that seems to actually be helping a little bit. He's kind of one of these forward-looking entrepreneur guys who if he doesn't have an agenda for the future, he keeps talking about how he's the only one with an agenda for the future. So Yang and Williamson, I actually thought, did pretty well. Night two, it was really the Harris and Biden show with everybody coming at Biden and Biden sort of defending. I thought Biden did okay. I'd give him sort of a sideways grade. I thought Kamala Harris didn't have a great night. I think to the extent that people weren't gunning for Biden, a few of them took aim at Harris, including Tulsi Gabbard, who's from Hawaii, who basically called Harris on her prosecutorial zeal as Attorney General of California, pointed out that part of the mass incarceration problem in California was a function of Harris's term as Attorney General, where she was very zealous in enforcing drug laws that, that lots of the Democratic candidates are now calling for decriminalization, especially of pot. And she pointed out that Harris, as she had been very zealous in this prosecution, had laughed in an interview when asked whether she, Harris, had smoked marijuana. And that was a devastating, that was a pretty devastating attack. And I'm shocked Harris didn't have a better reply. She had to know that was coming. So not a terrible night, but not a great moment for Harris. Biden, I think David Axelrod, again, Obama's advisor, was watching on CNN, had, I thought, the best line. He said, the good news is, you know, that was probably the best Biden could do. The bad news is that might be the best Biden can do. So I thought he was sort of sideways all night. I thought Cory Booker had a great night last night. Cory Booker has been very aggressive in attacking Biden in the last couple of weeks. Last night, in the Wednesday night debate, he basically said, I've already said what I need to say, and then simply took an opportunity to compare his record. At some point, Biden sort of said, well, your record and mine are very similar, and Booker said, I'm happy if you want to compare records. I'm a little surprised you want to compare records, which was a great line.
Yes.
A great line. And he had a smile on his face. And, you know, take a look at Cory Booker. He was, he's a senator from New Jersey. He's former mayor of Newark. Played football at Stanford. Actually kind of came from a pretty middle to upper middle class background. And I always thought there's sort of a sense he's a little guilty about that. So he actually lives in not just blue collar, but sort of tough neighborhoods now, and has done so for quite a while because he thinks, you know, he needs to be connected with the people in order to do what he wants to do. So he's an interesting candidate. He hasn't really done much up till now, but as I said, it's months before you actually have to do anything. And I thought he had a pretty good night last night. So a little overly simplistic, I suppose. You guys can get this sort of winners and losers stuff from cable TV, I suppose, but you came to us, so we'll give it to you. The big picture stuff, Professor McDaniel and I want to reiterate, and as you're thinking about your in-the-news answers that you want to talk about here, is America is just a very unusual campaign system where you have these two tiers of campaigns. We're spending all this time early on in July, it was July when the debates took place, for a Democratic primary contest where the first actual election is, you know, the Iowa caucuses, and that's not going to be until February. It's very odd. However, the debates have become important kind of precursors of the election, and they are consequential because Americans sort through who's credible and who's not. Do I want to give money to a candidate? Who am I supporting? Am I going to go volunteer for one of these candidates? And media has taken up a role. The parties used to do this. The parties used to basically tell the candidates, you're not going to be the nominee. Don't bother showing up. But they don't do that anymore. They've left it to us, the voters, and the media as kind of the intermediary, right, as the organizer and purveyor of this stuff. The media plays a big role, too. So the media and the voters have been put in a position that parties used to serve, screening candidates and deciding who should be the nominee. All right, so that's the big picture stuff. Are we good? Anything else we need to jump on here?
That's it from my end.
I think that's pretty good. So I've gone a little long. Thanks for your patience. Hopefully we kept you entertained. And stay cool. It's getting hot out there.
Yes, it is.
All right, talk to you next week.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.